Tehe moriora. Ko no chia ho. Ko fitarea I te monga. Ko porirua I te awa. Ko titahi bay I te whenua. Ko Aotearoa I na iwi. Nō reira, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. Which is a long-winded way of saying I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me to address you. I bring you greetings from your Sea of Faith friends on the other side of the world, on the right side of the world. Thank you for turning on such splendid weather for me. It's nice to think that the very day I speak here to the Sea of Faith Conference is your highest temperature ever. I think it's a lovely symbol, a lovely way to start things. Patty, thank you very much for your very kind introduction. Without going to any extraordinary effort, we can hear at one end of a spectrum a noisy Pentecostalist Christian waving her arms in the air and proudly proclaiming, "I believe, I believe, I believe." While at the other, an equally noisy atheist is stamping his foot and defiantly proclaiming, "I disbelieve, I disbelieve, I disbelieve." I hope to show that both parties are much closer to each other than they would suppose. For the purpose of this paper, the term willful disbelievers will name those people who say that they do not believe in the sense in which the word is used by people who make claims of religious affiliation. Although they may be self-labeled as skeptic, secular humanist, rationalist, atheist or agnostic, and although there are valuable distinctions between those appellations, many of my comments will be about and many of my examples will be drawn from humanism, as representative of a position both close to and distant from that of the common or Dover Beach Sea of Faith member. I hope to offer some thoughts as to how we might extend friendship to such people. They are, after all, fellow human beings. And I shall suggest that it is quite reasonable to say that they too have a religion, even though they deny it. Humanism, as it has been classically understood, can best be seen as putting into practice humanitas, or human virtue, as seen in the practices of understanding, benevolence, compassion, mercy, fortitude, justice, judgment, prudence, eloquence, and love of honour. Although these classical virtues have become marginalised recently by a sort of utilitarian calculus of personal fulfilment in modern life, they are useful for the present analysis because they too are elements of spirituality. In the 14th century, the theologian, ordained priest, and learned scholar Petrarch advanced the view, which came to be held by later humanists, that classical learning and Christian spirituality were not only compatible, but they were mutually fulfilling. Not all present-day humanists would agree. Because classical Christianity is acted out on a stage made of supernaturalist materials, against a backdrop of eternal and unchanging truths, it finds difficulty in making an easy marriage with the findings of the growing scientific method. The truths of traditional Christianity, which are arrived at without scientific rigor, and which are defended by a dogma that denies accountability, are said to deal with all phenomena, earthly or heavenly, all things visible and invisible. This, of course, comes into collision with the scientific tools of observation, deduction, and systematic doubt. The effects of that collision have not yet even begun to be fully worked through. But we should concede that it is the aims and the vocabularies of humanism that best suits our times, because our world is shaped by the findings of Copernicus, Galileo, Darwin, Freud, and Einstein, none of whose explanations speak of a supernatural provenance. Even if we were to say that God or the gods made the earth, it was humankind that makes and remakes the world. For practical and rhetorical purposes, we can allow that there are basically two kinds of humanism, secular and religious. Humanism is so often said to be the opposite of religion that it is difficult for most people to see the term religious humanism as anything other than a contradiction. Yet this has not always been so, and it is not now so for most subscribers to the Sea of Faith who use the term humanism to name human-centeredness. There is much in common between secular and religious humanism. Members of both groups agree that all human activity and all institutions are made only by humans, there being no other creative agency.
All of our art and culture and even our forms of religious expression are human products. While traditional Christianity is dedicated to opposing what it takes to be corrosive of spirituality, materialism, secularism and humanism, members of the Sea of Faith Network find value in materialist explanations of the origins of the cosmos, of life and of consciousness. This we share with secular humanism. We might even say that humans emerge up from the earth and not down from the heavens. Because this life is all that we will ever have, the secular is immensely important, and the human is where we locate our priorities and our values. Those of us who retain some affection for a Christian upbringing, but who can no longer assent to what we take to be its defining affirmations, we call ourselves post-Christian. We take the view that while institutional forms of Christian expression have more or less lost the plot remains important. All humanists have in common a sort of moral earnestness. We yearn for a better world, and the more active among us try to bring it about. Yet, we differ deeply. Religious humanists make the claim that the religious dimension of a human being is our best part, even while conceding that some forms of religious expression have done much harm. On the other hand, secular humanists show, in speech and in writing, what can justifiably be called a deep loathing of religion. While secular humanists call for no religion, religious humanists call for better religion. Oscar Wilde drew our attention to the fact that England and America are two countries separated by a common language. Similarly, much of what separates secular and religious humanists can be seen in the way that each uses certain key words. Of all areas of knowledge which deal with human activity, it is in the consideration of religion that there is the greatest muddlement. The religious lexicon is in a mess. There is at least a paper and probably an entire conference waiting to address this sad fact. Compare the different ways in which the following words are used in a religious and then in a popular context. Myth, mystery, truth, belief, faith, spirit. In what follows, I will recommend that we come down firmly on definitions of some key words. The first is to deliver spirituality from both its medieval concern with metaphysical dualism and from its late 20th century New Age uses. Then we will be free to promote it to name that capability which steers us towards religion in the first place. The second is to show that religion, while often expressed in supernatural terms, does not depend on them. Supernaturalism is an option, not an essence. The potential benefits of gaining some clarity in these matters are enormous. Not only will we find a forum in which to meet and greet our secularist friends, we might rescue faith from its fundamentalist prison and put it back, to use a quasi-biblical phrase, on the thrones of our hearts. In seeking to describe a relationship between spirituality and religion which will work in today's world, we must note the three-stage historical progression in the use of the word spirituality. The early and traditional use of the word can be found in most dictionaries. It speaks of two kinds of reality, with the spiritual above and the material below. It depends upon the acceptance of an unseen world, more real than this one, which reveals itself in visions and dreams and physical manifestations. We scurry round like ants down here below, while the perfect realm broods over us. This dualism, which owes a lot to Plato, is still embedded in mainstream Christianity. During the last half century, a new formulation of spirituality arose as a sort of personal substitute for stuffy old-fashioned religion. It became romanticized and democratized and was aided by the Orphic and the Gnostic ideas of interior journey. It became a scheme for opposing both secularist rationality and the dogmatism of the formal church. Linda Woodhead wrote of a new mode of post-theological theology in which it is not the theologian or the ecclesiastic who has the authority, but the individual engaged in the spiritual metaphysical quest based on his or her personal experiences. She cited Neil Donald Walsh's Conversations with God as typical of the published output. This development transferred the authoritative source of spirituality from the custodial care of ecclesiastical institutions to the commercial concerns of book publishers. It repotted the roots of spirituality in the ephemera of currently fashionable warm fuzzies and the dynamics of the publications of self-help books. So saccharine are some manifestations that they have attracted the Australian epithet New Age Wank. A third, and to me the most satisfactory definition of spirituality, commends itself because it talks of what is lodged in our very humanness. As Dostoevsky had one of his characters say in The Brothers Karamazov, "What is strange, what is marvellous, is not whether God really exists. The marvel is that such an idea, the idea of the necessity of God, could have entered the head of such a savage and vicious beast as man. So holy is it, so moving, so wise, and such a great honour it does to man." Because this usage has objective reality, we can see it in operation, it can be seen to subsume the two earlier definitions. Building on Tillich's idea of telos, or objective of human existence, the American theologian Owen Thomas defines spirituality as the sum of all the uniquely human capacities and functions, self-awareness, self-transcendence, memory, anticipation, rationality in the broadest sense, creativity, plus the moral, intellectual, social, political, aesthetic, and religious capacities, all understood as embodied. Now, this is so important and so essential to my thesis, I'm going to do it again. Owen Thomas defines spirituality as the sum of all the uniquely human capacities and functions, self-awareness, self-transcendence, memory, anticipation, rationality in the broadest sense, creativity, plus the moral, intellectual, social, political, aesthetic, and religious capacities, all understood as embodied. Under this definition, spirituality is a natural phenomenon, unlike the medieval dualist supernaturalism, and it is an enduring phenomenon, unlike Oprah's Book of the Month approach. Such spirituality is oriented to this life and to this world and to this time. It is part of the human condition. It lurks in the pockets of our genes. Spirituality is best seen not as the free thinker's alternative to religion, but as its very source. This clears the way for the word religion to name spirituality in action, with its built-in counterpoints, the urge and the expression, the communal and the personal, talking about and participating in. Here's another confusion. In everyday speech, faith and belief often mean provisional knowledge, as in, I believe that it will rain tomorrow. Well, we hope it'll rain. I believe that it will. It's provisional knowledge. But both Christian scriptures and radical religious humanists of the Sea of Faith use the term to name a much more profound matter. It is not merely believing that, but of believing in. It is an existential concern. It is what holds your conscience captive. Faith and belief are questions of trustworthiness, obedience, and value. You seek, like a swimmer, to be able to put your feet down and to feel solid ground. Everyone at some time has these experiences. The sociologist Robert Bellah wrote more than 30 years ago, "It is no longer possible to divide mankind into believers and non-believers." You see, everyone believes in something. But the word religion names the secular humanists' biggest scandal. Their publications do not define religion as much as characterize it and then proceed to denounce it from an assumption that religion is inescapably supernaturalist, corrupt, and daft. As Rob Wheeler of the Sea of Faith in the UK observed, "The trouble with most books arguing for secular humanism is they start with a crude critique of religion, focusing in an entirely unbalanced way on the horrors committed by Roman Catholicism in the past and the idiocies of evangelicals and fundamentalists in the present. Having shown that religion is mad, bad, dangerous and false, they tend to assume that there is nothing else that they have to do. Secular humanism naturally follows by default, QED, and requires no justification in its own right. At this point, we can all stop thinking. Sadly, most dictionaries of English still define religion in terms of a supernatural order of reality and our consequent behaviour towards it. While it is the function of a dictionary to record current usage, I believe that it is our job to reform it. Those of us who are religious but do not subscribe to supernaturalism take the view that those who do are guilty of only mistaking metaphor for metaphysics, of mistaking the map for the territory. Religious ideas are not propositions which invite debate, evidence, rebuttal, and logical proof. Instead, they grow out of innate spirituality and deal with matters of existential importance, of what is so valuable that we would be at all times guided by it and we would commit our lives to it. Ironically, but significantly, the passionate anti-religious humanist, too, knows this feeling of deep commitment. The following passage by Richard Dawkins, that voluble scourge of all things religious, refers to Ursula Goodenough's book, The Sacred Depths of Nature. I quote, "Yet by the book's own account, Goodenough does not believe in any sort of supreme being, does not believe in any sort of life after death. By any normal understanding of the English language, she is no more religious than I am. She shares with other atheistic scientists a feeling of awe at the majesty of the universe and the intricate complexity of life. If that is religion, then I am a deeply religious man. But it isn't, and I'm not. As far as I can tell, my atheistic views are identical to Ursula's religious ones. One of us is misusing the English language, and I don't think it's me. But I think he's being willfully obstructive. Let me tell you why. To insist that religious thought and expression are obliged to offer supernatural explanations is similar to asking physicists to still speak of phlogiston as the active agent for fire, for astronomers to defer to Ptolemy, doctors to prescribe according to Galen, and for biologists to declare that crocodiles emerge spontaneously from the mud on the banks of the Nile. To imprison religious expression in pre-Enlightenment thought forms, as many conservative Christians still lovingly do, and as Dawkins does for ease of ridicule, is outdated, dishonest, or both. All forms of human thought move on, and so must the religious. One of the most significant scientific reappraisals occurred in the early 1960s with Thomas Kuhn's concept of the paradigm shift. By this term, he referred to the radical changes of the accepted perspective which periodically disturb a particular scientific discipline and which permit previously problematic research data to find relevance. At the same time, the Anglican Bishop of Woolwich, John A.T. Robinson, published Honest to God, a comparable religious paradigm shift. Since then, there has been an upwelling of scholarly analysis and reflection about Christianity in particular and religion in general. Advances in archaeology, of comparative literature and depth psychology leave us open to talk of religion in terms that do not shackle it to the supernatural. That is why radical Christians and post-Christians of the Sea of Faith Network can use religion in the following terms, which are offered by the Canadian historian of religion, Wilfred Campbell Smith. He said that when we talk about religion, that is without a qualifying a or the, then we are talking about personal piety or faith, the realized spirituality of an individual human being, without reference to any particular formalized path of faith. But when we use the expression a religion, or the plural form religions, then we are talking about historical cultural phenomena, such as Christianity, Judaism, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and so on. They each have a history, and they change over time, usually in response to other historical phenomena which impinge on them. The traditions are ongoing and cumulative. Much ink has been spilled and much internet bandwidth occupied in failing to maintain the distinction between religion and a religion. This sort of unsought, hardwired itch, which we can equate to Owen Thomas's spirituality, may be scratched in countless different ways. What we personally identify as sacred, we commit ourselves to deeply, even totally. Under the same rubric, full phenomena as diverse as the hymn-shouting Pentecostalist, the Theravadan Buddhist who is indifferent to the notion of God, the somber Anglican bishop, the mystic of many flavours, Sufi, Hindu, Christian, New Age, spontaneous and passive, as well as the atheist who fulminates against any or all of the preceding. The itch is universal in spiritually pregnant Homo sapiens, while the range of scratches is so extensive as to include even points of view as contradictory as fundamentalist Pentecostalism and atheism. Following Owen Thomas, we might use Tillich's words to define spirituality when manifest as religion, as the state of being grasped by an ultimate concern, a concern which qualifies all other concerns as preliminary. And we can quote Ronald Kavanagh for its expression. Religion is the varied symbolic expression of an appropriate response to that which people deliberately affirm as being of unrestricted value to them. Note the absence of any reference to the supernatural or any prescription as to the form of its expression. Our itch, our yearning, is for the realization of our humanness. Our hardwired spiritual potential pushes us to aspire to transcendence. The pursuit of transcendence is a religious pursuit. This approach is not without difficulties. The most obvious was raised by Richard Dawkins when he wrote, "But if the term religion is allowed such a flabby, elastic definition, what word is left for conventional religion, religion as the ordinary person in the pew or on the prayer mat understands it today? Indeed, as any intellectual would have understood it in previous centuries when intellectuals were religious like everybody else." Dawkins thinks that he wants another noun. What he really needs are some qualifying adjectives. There are two other difficulties. Given such a generous definition, it is possible to count some of the more resolutely anti-religious secular humanists as being religious, if only because of the sincerity of the anti-religious feelings. The Marxist with a hammer in one hand and a sickle in the other is gripped by a deep archetypal image of ancient wrong and future justice. To value a life free from supernatural superstition and commit oneself to that belief is a matter of deep personal integrity. The particular way in which the skeptic puts integrity into action is to reject the cant, the double talk, and the hostility to enlightenment knowledge that for so long has stood for Christian orthodoxy. Anti-Christian? Yes. Religious? Yes. The other difficulty arises where one's ultimate concern is something commonly held to be deeply bad. Nazism, cannibalism, and Satanism have all attracted people who have given over their lives unconditionally. One response could be to say that if it is that bad, then it is not really religion. But that would be an evasion. We ought to honestly concede that they are religious expressions, but that they lack the life-affirming focus by which we applaud most forms. Retain the noun, use more adjectives. It is 40 years since the cover of Time magazine asked, "Is God dead?" Don Cupid gave an answer 5 years ago by accounting for the death of God in terms of the death of Plato's influence on us. A generation ago, we might have found grounds for thinking that religious faith and practice were fading away, at least in the West. Dwindling church membership then and now supported that view. It was widely assumed that as people became more educated, they would give up on religion. Secular humanists pray for that day, well, sort of. Several major developments have abruptly changed all that, and religion has erupted into the news media. We see ancient paths of faith subverted to terrorism and to militarism. David Bolton, a Quaker and a prominent member of the UK network of Sea of Faith, wrote, "Today, barely halfway through the first decade of the 21st century, in the third Christian millennium, we are living through a mighty revival of religion in its crudest, most bigoted, most pernicious forms." Let's consider two examples. Politicisation of religion mixed with terrorism and hostility to reason. The interaction between a formalised religion and a political point of view was always a difficult one. Each, according to their precepts, makes claims to be the commanding viewpoint in the life of the subscriber. If religion is to be taken seriously, then surely it sets the agenda for all major decision making. But politics makes its claims too, of idealism, of pragmatism, of feet on the ground. We must observe that not all expressions of faith result in tolerance for other points of view. And so a secular, independent keeper of the peace is needed. As the Australian religious broadcaster Rachel Cohn said, the secular democratic society is the best guardian of religious freedom. Most promoters of religion will defend its irrational nature on the grounds that religion is subjective rather than objective, inviting us to undertake non-scientific activities such as declaring value, of loving, of being compassionate. But we may not defend incursions into the domain of science if, in doing so, the scientific method itself is violated. Much of intelligent design attracts such accusations. It is not, as a rationalist might say, that science is superior, it's just different. Classical Christianity has made life difficult for itself by preserving pre-scientific knowledge in dogma, like spiders in amber, long after it has been superseded. Lloyd Gearing speaks as strongly as any humanist, even atheist, against theism, and he argues passionately for a Christianity without theism. These are some of the characteristics of theism, the belief in a real suprapersonal God, that Lloyd Gearing dislikes. Theism, he said, added to purely human words a dimension of absolute authority which they do not deserve. For centuries, the Western world has encouraged us to believe that our future is in the hands of a benevolent and all-powerful God, and that we have been placed here on earth to prepare for an eternal destiny elsewhere. Atrocities of many kinds have been conducted in the name of religious faith. A catalogue would exceed the size of this paper. But it is too simple just to say that it follows that an improvement could be made by banning religious faith. Indeed, the suggestion is so ludicrous in its Canute-like naivety that it ranks alongside any suggestions to ban sex, automobiles, alcohol and chocolate. The way forward is to follow the analysis of Cantwell Smith and to separate the itch from the scratch. We can allow that spirituality is by definition good and that the bad appears in some forms of its expression, as it does in the oft-quoted parallel case of sexuality. So this paper takes the view that the itch, which takes on many names, spirituality, religion, faith, belief, integrity and so on, is that which seeks to promote the human condition. It is as ubiquitous as language, and it is problematic as sexuality. And like sexuality, the uses to which the religious disposition may be put are widespread. We deplore some of those uses without demanding an end to the underlying spirituality. So, who needs religion? Don Cupid found that the idiomatic uses of the words life and it all now occupy the same space that God once routinely occupied in everyday speech. It is a widespread attitude among seer faith people that a religious outlook on life is not only healthy, but is essential to a fully realized life. While the secularization of especially the West has brought many advantages, it has also left something of what George Steiner referred to as a nostalgia for the absolute, a sense of disarray, a desiccation. This loss is felt at the personal level too. Carl Jung wrote, "Among all of my patients in the second half of life, that is to say over the age of 35, there has not been one whose problem in the last resort was not that of finding a religious outlook on life. It is safe to say that every one of them feel ill because he had lost that which the living religions of every age have given to their followers, and not one of them has been really healed who did not regain his religious outlook." It would be an insult to the work of Jung and countless others to fail to see past the stereotypical old man in the sky with a beard approach. The religious humanist takes the view that while secular humanism has many commendable features, it offers an incomplete reading of all the richness and potential of the human person. We are born to transcend the Darwinian legacy. I am not proposing metaphysical transcendence, but what I have called aspirational transcendence. As Feuerbach said in a lecture in 1848, we are all born as animals, and if the circumstances are right, we develop both the aspiration and the competence to transcend our animal substrate to become spiritual beings. And we can do it without leaving home, let alone the planet. Let us be clear, transcendence does not look to the denial of the flesh, but it does assign the highest priority to spiritual attitudes, to love, faith, hope, and mutual support. It is these fruits of the Spirit that should have the casting vote and not the flesh. Relegate the flesh, but do not deny it. The kind of life that our humanness invites us into is one best undertaken in reconciling that which our analytical science has put asunder. To consider such demands, it's necessary to recognise that a large percentage of our mental processes are subconscious, subjective, and irrational. We all possess an unconscious region of the mind which is not accessible to conscious introspection. Those who spend most of their mental activity in ascetic pursuits attest to the sheer delight in not being bound to reason with its stern capital R. Wholeness is the stated goal of both the religious Christian tradition and the secular psychotherapeutic tradition. Our Western Christian tradition has looked to the church to facilitate a process of reprioritization in which the spiritual values of mercy, pity, peace and love are made to override the fear and greed and self-absorption that is our animal legacy. Today it is common for us to ask the psychoanalyst to help bring the conscious and the unconscious aspects of a person's mind into harmony. During the 20th century, Christian religious thought moved in the direction of existentialism. It did this at the expense of the grand historical tradition of institutionalism. The New Ages were doing this in leaps and bounds. But Don Cupid's quarrel with traditional Christianity identifies a more fundamental problem. The whole history of Western metaphysics, from Plato to Nietzsche, rested upon a mistake, and it was a very bad mistake. We were running away from time, finitude and contingency. We forsook being and took refuge in dreams of absolute security, rational necessity, timelessness, and total knowledge and control. But now, with the end of metaphysics, philosophy is at last, long last, returned to its original and founding question, the question of being. The cognitive content of religious expression has been shown to be almost totally bankrupt. We can't go to where we want to get to via rational thought, any more than we can get satisfaction by eating the menu. Anthony Flew wrote, "Man is in a condition of anxiety arising from the realization of his necessary freedom of choice, of the ignorance of the future, of his awareness of manifold possibilities, and of the finiteness of an existence that was preceded by and must terminate in nothingness." This is the very anxiety that Cupid suggests that we must live with, even revel in it. By dismantling the gods, by taking leave of the Christian God, we are then able to grow up into the human creatures that we might be. To reify is to treat an abstraction as though it were concretely real. Many of the authors already quoted look on religion as a life-guiding abstraction, as for example in Campbell Smith's Personal Faith. But because it is an abstraction, it is hard to visualize. So Don Cupid's definition of some years ago, God is the religious concern reified. The abstraction, religious concern, is clothed in personhood and so made available to thought. I've argued that religious expression must be allowed and encouraged to undergo paradigm shifts, as have science and economics and much else. It is a commonplace among members of Sea of Faith that, for the expression of faith to be genuine, it must be one's own. Lloyd Gearing wrote, "The moral imperative which we experience in the human condition has been internalized. This does not make morality any less important than it was before, but it does make it possible for us to become more and more morally responsible people." So growing up may entail taking leave of an externally imposed morality and even of God. Or even to insist that an honest God is the noblest work of man. I started this paper with a discussion of humanitas as the development of human virtue. While no one could dispute the value of understanding, benevolence, compassion, mercy, fortitude, judgment, and a love of honour, we might have a niggling suspicion that they are not sufficient for the building of a realised human existence. Furthermore, I take it that what is left out of the secularist creed is already informally present in the lives of my willful disbelievers, but resolutely ignored, much like an inebriated uncle at one's daughter's wedding. Human beings have two capabilities which are so much in evidence that they separate us from other animals to a significant degree. We can even conjecture that they are hardwired. One is the capacity for language. which in the majority of people is expressed in one or more of the natural languages. The other is a capacity to ascribe life-directing significance to people, to places, events, and ideologies. In the majority of people, this is expressed in involvement with a formal path of faith and/or an ideological movement such as communism, and/or in social activism such as Amnesty International and Greenpeace, and/or in any one of a multitude of society watchdog organisations such as the several humanist or rationalist or sceptic organisations. We in the West live in a disenchanted world in which many hunger for the mental, emotional and spiritual life which was previously fed by ritual and rich metaphor and myth. In seeking nourishment, many now fall prey to political spin doctors and to the advertising industry which has never stopped believing that there is an irrational component to the human psyche. The postmodern 21st century cannot give us assurances of any kind. Things are just too free-floating. Like Abraham, each of us must be prepared to set out with only our faith and without any forward reservations. We are invited to simply throw in our lot with life and to accept in faith that simply being human is worthwhile. Since the language of faith deals with the most profound aspects of our existence, then existential truth is much more relevant to our faith than is the philosophical or the logical. Scientific and philosophical truth equips us to handle the objective world about us, while existential truth helps us interact subjectively with objects of value, including ourselves. For the most part, secular humanists value the first meaning, while religious humanists embrace both. Or to put it another way, if a secular humanist embraces the second version, then she is already on the slippery slope towards religion. Once we step into the domain where we deal with what the scientific method systematically excludes, subjectivity, aesthetics, moral claims, then we are entering the area in which religion operates. The Canadian academic novelist and critic Robertson Davies put it like this. In the modern world, we are obsessed with the notion that to think is the highest achievement of mankind. But we neglect the fact that thought, untouched by feeling, is thin, delusive, treacherous stuff. A purely secular world is simply not able to safeguard that which is most precious about being human. 20 years ago in New Zealand, hard right economic policy and a surrender to the dynamics of the market elevated fear and greed to primary virtues, and social compassion died. Neither is the scientific viewpoint a sufficiently rich foundation on which to build a life, because in order to operate objectively, science must ignore our subjectivity. While that is good for science, the very subjectivity of which we are made, all our hopes, loves, fears, ecstasies, joys and terrors are of no account. The philosopher Jacques Monod was no friend of religion, but he touched a nerve when he wrote, "The ancient covenant is now in pieces. Man at last knows that he is alone in the unfeeling immensity of the universe, out of which he emerged only by chance. Neither his destiny nor his duty have been written down. The kingdom above or the darkness below, it is for him to choose." Any new and radical approach to religious thought must start at about that point and must acknowledge what older systems of dogmatic religious certitude denied, that time passes destructively, that events, good and bad, just happen without pity for any of the victims, that death is the last stop on the tram ride of our lives. To change the metaphor, we're all in the same captainless and rudderless boat, and we must turn to each other for warmth, for support, and for the encouragement by which the humanness latent in us all can flower. We must start here now, because this is the only time and the only world that we will ever know. Get that right, and something worthy to be called God will emerge. What has the Sea of Faith Network got to offer a secular humanist? At least we are neither a church nor a church substitute. We call us a talk shop, wherein any or all ideas about the expression of faith are heard sympathetically. One of our members described the Sea of Faith as a safe place in which to talk about unsafe things. I get rueful nods of acknowledgement when I refer to the Sea of Faith as a sort of detox centre. There are even some capital H humanists among our membership of the Sea of Faith in New Zealand who are made more comfortable by there being no assertions of dogmatic certitude nor definitions of orthodoxy. Some of these humanists can be awfully dogmatic. We are not being supernaturalist when we affirm that God or the gods are figures of speech, which we deny at our peril. So is it time to look to a convergence between Sea of Faith and such humanist groups who preach that religion is irredeemably supernaturalist? My own view is that it will eventually be possible, but it will take time. Just as there are devout religious hardliners who promote religion over against a devalued world, there remain, if the published humanist journals are any guide, a dyed-in-the-wooliness, unreflecting hostility to the word religion or any of its synonyms, having earlier in their lives dismissed the book, smashed the bell and snuffed the candle. They don't want to go there again. Humanists need to be aware that voices like Cupid's are saying that the dualism of classic Christianity is no longer sustainable in the face of post-Enlightenment science. But that very science and its model of a single observer independent reality is itself looking somewhat shaky. Similarly, but slowly, the way in which we recognise, acknowledge and respond to the religious concern must be encouraged to change as our perception of what it is to be human changes. I incline to the view that, like monarchy, the institutional church has had its day, and that people like us should be presenting alternatives. Like a plant nursery, we should be planting seeds of faith and encouraging anybody who will to find homes for them out in the wider world. Perhaps we should eventually rename our network the Seedbed of Faith. The listener might detect that I am at the dry end of religious phenomena. I'm uncomfortable with ritual and liturgy and claims of mystics. It may be that, as it is between me and some poets and musicians, I just don't get it, and that maybe one day the penny will drop. But just as the warm, moist yin end of faith expression is difficult for me, it is likely to pose an even greater challenge to willful disbelievers for whom faith is indistinguishable from reprehensible credulity. I hope that by now my listeners will have detected some recurrent themes. Let me bring this address to a close with the following bullet point summary, which I will offer to willful disbelievers as the beginning of what might prove to be a mutually beneficial dialogue. We are physical creatures before we are mental creatures. And we are mental creatures before we are spiritual creatures. Our conscious selves crouch on top of a causal pyramid, the nature of which is being slowly understood. We are contingent creatures, built of atoms, defined by genes, bullied by hormones, buoyed by endorphins, tortured by nightmares, and inspired by good music, good poetry, and good preaching. We each have a unique provenance, and we each live a unique life. We have two strongly exercised capabilities which separate us from other animals to a significant degree: a hardwired capacity for language and a hardwired capacity for spirituality and its social manifestation as religion, which ascribes life-directing significance to people, places, events, and ideologies. This definition of spirituality encompasses the others, and it accounts for them. So powerful is this urge that we feel bound, religare, to do something about it. Its forms of expression are so various as to sometimes encompass violent contradictions. The expression of religious faith does not of necessity require an acceptance of supernatural agencies or realms, even though many take that option. Scientific discoveries require us to look for improved metaphors by which to express the sheer wonder of life on earth. If scientific paradigms may be modernized, why not religious ones also? New expressions of religious faith are constantly emerging. In recent decades, there has been a re-emphasis on earth-centered values and rituals. Many radically religious people, post-theistic, post-Christian, religious humanists, and many others, take the view that the earth is our only home, ever. It is not merely a transit lounge in which we piously wait for death to waft us away to another world above the bright blue sky. Although Christianity persists as the majority path of faith in the West, it is largely shorn of its political clout, except in the neoconservative United States. Christianity is so diverse in its forms, practices, and creeds, and has changed so much over time as to not be readily described or critiqued without considerable qualification. Christianity is shrinking numerically while shedding its liberals and its radicals. In a circling the wagons response, spokespeople are moving towards a purity model of Christianity and away from the compassion approach of Jesus. Our deepest values, including the right to choose or reject expressions of faith, are best protected by secular government. While humans exist, religion will persist in one form or another because to ascribe value and to commit utterly to it is an essential part of being human. The search for better ways will go on as long as humans exist, because at rock bottom, that is what religion is. The ambition to be radically, totally human is about as sacred as it gets. The difference in our time is that we're now free to experiment with expressions of faith as never before. We may even find that those who willfully disbelieve are really believers after all. Thank you.